You're listening to the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast, where Irish fitness entrepreneur Brian Keane answers your questions and interviews leaders in the world of fitness, health, mindset, and natural wellness. Come join the fun.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast. We talk everything fitness, nutrition, and mindset to help you with your goals. Today's episode is going to be a Q&A, and I've pulled these questions from my Instagram, Brian Keane Fitness, and my Snapchat, Brian K019. So if you're not following me on those platforms, as soon as this episode is over, definitely go check those out. That is where I take most of the questions for the podcast, as they're my most two active platforms at the minute, particularly Instagram. I'm spending an ungodly amount of time on Instagram at the minute. So I'll jump straight into the first question and we'll rock and roll with today's episode. So first question comes in from Thomas Brogan 2 on Instagram. Do you believe you can build muscle and get lean at the same time, or should you just cut and bulk? So this is one of these topics that I've covered a couple of times on my Snapchat Q&As, and I'm going to flesh it out and expand on it for the podcast. I know there's different people that listen to the podcast and download the podcast that may not be following my Snapchat or may not have seen the story anytime I talk on this. The truth is, you can build muscle and lose body fat or get leaner at the same time. It's just significantly easier to do a cut or a bulk. So cutting and bulking, again, depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a different definition. But in the context of this answer, I'm going to say a cut is anything under your calorie maintenance. So your maintenance calories are the amount you need to stay the same weight or the same body composition. So if your maintenance calories is 2,000, a cut is going to be anything below 2,000 calories. A bulk then is going to be a calorie surplus, anything above your maintenance, so anything above 2,000 calories. So in order to change your body composition and build muscle and lose body fat, or if you want to bulk up or get leaner and cut down, it's way easier just to eat more calories than your maintenance or eat less calories than your maintenance in order to cut or bulk. That's why most people do one or the other. That being said, you can potentially build muscle and lose body fat at the same time. It's just a little bit harder because you've got to line up all your dominoes and then knock them all over. You have to make sure that your nutrition is geared towards that, your training is geared towards that, and then any supplements you're using are geared towards building muscle and losing body fat at the same time. There's also a lot of hormonal things that are going on. Your own metabolism, your own genetics are going to have an effect. You're going to have come into play here. But you can do both. The key is to make sure that you're getting enough calories in order to build muscle, and then that you're playing around with different macronutrients at different times in order to keep yourself a little bit more insulin sensitive, so that you're able to utilize the calories for recovery, you're able to utilize the calories that you eat, your carbohydrates to replenish glycogen, you're able to utilize the protein that you eat to repair the fibers you're tearing down in your workouts, and you're getting good quality healthy fats to make up the rest of those calories. But you're also not eating too much that's going to spill you over and make you bulk up or bloat or add extra body fat to your frame. So what I would advise, if you're looking to build muscle, and this is regardless of gender, because girls will look to build muscle as well. Some of you will frame it in the wording of toning up, but it's effectively the same thing. Lean muscle, muscle tissue is lean by definition. So toning up, building muscle aren't necessarily a different change or don't look differently on the body. It's just that there are different words that get thrown around depending on gender, but they're largely the same thing. It's lean muscle tissue you're trying to add to your frame. And then losing body fat is obviously reducing the amount of fat in your body. Before I go a little bit further and flesh this out and expand on it, it's worth noting that body fat, losing body fat or adding body fat and losing weight or adding weight are not the same thing. Weight is number on a scale. Body fat is the fat on your body. So in order to build muscle, you may not necessarily have to add that much weight on the scale. You may be able to increase the size of a muscle. So if you, for example, you're measuring your arms or measuring your chest or measuring your glutes or measuring your quads, and that size is increasing and your body fat is decreasing and you're checking it with different calipers or you're using a DEXA scan, you can potentially see that you're increasing actual muscle size and reducing fat at your body at the same time. It just means that your calories aren't dropping too low that you're in a cut, and they're not going super high that you're in a traditional bulk. You're staying in a slight surplus, so you're getting enough in order to repair from workouts, and you're getting enough and you're spacing meals out, and you are getting the quality ingredients that your body needs and can utilize, and that is going to support you building muscle and losing body fat at the same time. What you also want to factor in is your training program. What I have a personal preference in doing when I'm trying to build muscle and lose body fat at the same time is I'm prioritizing a little bit higher intensity workouts. I like supersets, tri-sets, giant sets, where you're doing different movements back to back. You're working all your different body parts, not necessarily in the same workout. I have a personal preference towards push-pull legs. Push where you're doing all your push body parts, your chest, your shoulders, your triceps. Pull where you're doing your pulling movements, your back, rear delts and biceps, and then legs where you're hitting lower body. That's my personal preference and training style when I'm trying to do both at the same time. It also allows you to hit every body part, and if you're doing that split doubled over, it means that you're hitting every body part twice a week. So if you're doing push pull legs rest day, it means you're hitting your every body part twice a week. And if you're doing push pull legs push pull, it means that you're getting everything in your upper body twice a week. So you may change the training program around based on whatever it is that you're trying to achieve, whatever body part it is that you're trying to bring up, but you are making sure that you're getting enough stimulus on all those different muscle groups so that you're able to build muscle onto your frame. The other important element to factor in is going to be your cardio. When you're trying to do both at the same time, it's probably going to support you more factoring in a higher intensity form of cardio where you're able to elevate your heart rate and burn calories during the workout, but you're not going to start eating into muscle. One of the fears that a lot of bodybuilders and bikini girls can have is that they do excess cardio, they'll eat into muscle, and you definitely can do that. If you're doing way too much cardio and loads of jogging or low intensity cardio, and your calories aren't that high and you're not supporting your body with refueling after workouts or throughout the entire day, you can definitely eat into muscle and lose some muscle that way, which can potentially slow down your metabolism. The more lean muscle tissue you have in your body, the faster your metabolism is going to be, which means the more calories you're going to be able to burn. So it's important that factor in the likes of a high intensity interval training, your HIIT cardio, because you're going to preserve more muscle because you're spending less time doing cardio, but you're still getting a similar bang for your buck in terms of and getting your heart rate up, increasing your heart rate so you can burn more calories during the actual workout. So number one is going to be your nutrition, making sure that you have everything geared in terms of your calories in, your calories out. You're in a slight surplus. So if your maintenance is 2000, as I mentioned, you might want to play around with that 2400, 2500 to 2,500 calorie mark. You may want to play around with your nutrition in terms of cycling your carbohydrate. My personal preference is high carbohydrates on the hardest training days, moderate carbohydrate intake on your moderate training days, and then low carbohydrate on rest days. Again, it varies person to person, but that's a system that tends to work very well for me and people that come through my programs. And then your training is going to be based on a little bit of a higher intensity. You're going to have supersets, tri-sets, giant sets, so you can keep your heart rate elevated during the workout, and you're going to prioritize high intensity interval training as your cardio so you can preserve the muscle you have while also elevating your heart rate. The last thing then is going to be your supplements. So always base any supplements you use off whatever your specific goal is at the moment in time. If you're prioritizing building muscle, you're going to look into things like creatine that can pull water underneath the cell and make you potentially stronger in your workouts or potentially able to move more weight than you normally would because of the water that's been pulled underneath the muscle. You may find that that will help support you building muscle onto your frame. Things like beta-alanine that can buffer lactic acid, leucine or branched-chain amino acids, that again are the most anabolic. Leucine is one of the most anabolic amino acids that you can get. You can supplement that back in to add muscle size. And then when you're trying to lose body fat, you may be prioritizing with things like L-carnitine tartrate, where you are pushing fat cells out of the mitochondria to be burned for fuel, or green tea extract, which has a component ECGC, which is a metabolism boosting ingredient that can allow you burn more calories throughout the day. And then if you're trying to do both, you just combine those supplements. So you may use creatine and beta-alanine because you want to build muscle, and you may use L-carnitine tartrate and green tea extract because you want to lose body fat. You just combine them. So people that come through my program that have this as a goal, where they want to build muscle or tone up and lose body fat at the same time, that's kind of how we would structure the program. There'd be some form of higher intensity element in the training with high intensity cardio. The nutrition would be in a slight calorie surplus with a carb cycling element, and then your supplement plan or guide or options would be based around the most scientifically proven ones for building muscle and the most scientifically proven ones for losing body fat that don't have a negative effect on your body. So in terms of doing both, that is how I would lay it out. But as I said, that's a lot more complicated than just cutting or bulking. To cut, you just go into a calorie deficit. To bulk, you just go into a calorie surplus. So in terms of can you do both, yes, and that's how I would do it. And a lot of people that come through my online program, that's what we do. But whether you should cut or bulk or whether you should try and do both is very much down to personal preference and whatever it is that you're trying to achieve with your body composition. Okay, next question comes in from Snapchat. Is it normal for your face to get fatter when you're bulking? So I answered this one on a Snapchat Q&A a couple of weeks ago, and I joked that everything gets fatter when we bulk, but it's not really true, because what happens with a lot of people when we bulk, and if your face starts to get fatter, it's normally not the fact that you're bulking in a calorie surplus. It's normally that when you're bulking, or you even have that mindset of bulking, you generally are making poorer food choices, which means that you're eating more sugary foods or higher sodium foods. And as a result, your face is starting to swell from the water retention from those foods. That tends to be what happens with the majority of people when they bulk. I have had people that I've worked with and the people that are coming through my online program where they're bulking up, and I'll use that as context for this answer. When we're using high quality ingredients, good quality foods, you don't tend to get that face bloat in your face, because when you're bulking up and you're in a calorie surplus and you're using high quality foods, your body is utilizing those calories to add size to your frame. It's not just going to swell and fatten up your face. But when you're eating lots of pizza or lots of ice cream or lots of sodium or lots of sugar, what can happen to a lot of people, and what happens with a lot of people, and I've been a victim of this in the past, is you have this mindset of I'm bulky and I can kind of eat what I want and it doesn't really matter. You're not massively tracking how high a quality food that you're eating, and as a result, all that water retention is coming into your face. So in terms of, is it normal for your face to get fatter when you're bulking? No. But yes, if you are making poorer food choices because you're bulking. That's why I'm not actually a massive fan of the word bulking. Like, the truth is, if you want to bulk up and add size to your frame or add size to your body, you're better off to not think that you're bulking, because what happens sometimes with that subconscious thought is I can kind of eat what I want. And I'm speaking from someone who's lived that. When I was 19 or 20 and I would be bulking up, I would make the worst food choices, because I would justify it to myself going, well, I'm bulking, it doesn't matter, I can have this ice cream, I can have, you know, this high sodium food. For me, it was like bags of Walkers and crisps, and I would justify it to myself going, it doesn't matter, I'm bulking, it's fine. And that isn't necessarily the best way to get the best results. By all means, if that's how you want to bulk and you're like, you know what, I don't really care what I'm eating, then that's perfectly fine. But don't fool yourself when you're the easiest person to fool. Don't make poor food choices and then when your face bloats up, wonder what's happening. But if you want to make poor food choices because you're bulking up and you don't really care, just be aware that some of the side effects or consequences that come with that may be a fatter face or more water retention or more bloat, and you just may not feel as good. You might be a little bit more sluggish than normal, and you may just not have the same energy levels. So again, if that's what you're choosing to do, by all means do that and make the poorer food choices, but just be aware that it's something that's in your control and isn't necessarily the way you have to bulk up. That's just one way that people bulk up, and it's normally just a justification to eat shitty food, where you can bulk up and add size to your frame using high quality ingredients, good quality foods, and add more muscle and retain it, and feel so much better. Your energy levels will be increased, your strength will be increased, you'll feel so much better and you'll look so much better. So there are different alternative ways of doing it. So it's not necessarily normal, but it is if you're making poor food choices. So it's very much down to each individual person then on what you decide to do. Next question comes in from Snapchat. I can't feel my back contract on rows. Have you any tips? Yes. So one of the things that I regularly see with people is they struggle to feel their back when they're doing any row or pull movement. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is obviously you can't see your back, so it's a lot harder. What happens sometimes when we're training a muscle group we can see, it's a lot easier to see or feel that muscle contract. When we're doing biceps, we can see a pump in our arms and it makes it a little bit easier. If we're doing a chest movement and we're able to touch our pectoral muscles, neuromuscularly respond to touch. It's why sometimes if you're doing a concentration curl for your bicep and you're tapping your arm, you get a better squeeze on your bicep, because that's how your body responds. It's a neuromuscular response and it can actually improve your mind-muscle connection, which is your ability to feel the muscle and contract the muscle that you're trying to contract, which means you can load it for extra resistance and potentially grow it faster. So in terms of feeling your back contracting on rows, I've got a couple of tips that I do with people. One is make sure you're not going too heavy on the weight. One of the regular feedbacks that I get from people, particularly when I'm training in the gym, because I've got a massive back. I've got a huge back from years and years of rows. It was always a body part that I used to train. Particularly, I used to have a pretty bad imbalance through the front delts and my shoulders. I had to do a lot of back work and rear delts to try and pull my body back into alignment. The story for another day, it wasn't necessarily the best way to do it, but as a result, I have a pretty big back and a very detailed amount of muscle in my back. So it was a bit of a blessing in that sense. But one of the most commented things that comes my way is people asking why I'm lifting so light. And again, light is very subjective to each person, because what's heavy for one person isn't heavy for somebody else. If you're a 40 kilo girl, what's heavy for you is not going to feel heavy to an extra, you know, power lifting 120 kilo guy. So heavy and light are very subjective depending on each person. But in terms of back, there's a reason why I don't go super heavy, and that's down to the fact that I'm trying to contract my back muscles every time I'm doing a rowing movement, so that I'm completely adding the resistance to the part of my back that I'm trying to work. And what happens with people when they're doing particularly row movements, so barbell row, bent over row, dumbbell row, is you're gripping the weight in your hand and your forearms and biceps are closer to that weight. So the actual biomechanical movement pattern can load and resist and add resistance to that body part or those body parts first. So your back never actually fully contracts. And a lot of people who will do a row movement will feel that their biceps give up before their actual back gives up. And that means that you've probably gone too heavy or else your form was off, because your biceps shouldn't be pulling a bent over barbell row or a dumbbell row. That's a sign that the weight's too heavy or else your mind muscle connection is poor with your back, and you need to drop it down and try and contract through your back on each row movement. So the number one tip I'll offer is drop the weight back and then combine that with tucking in your elbows and then squeezing up through your back on each movement. Even if you have to drop the weight really low. To give context, I row with about 10 kilo dumbbells. Again, I can go significantly heavier and I've got a strong mind muscle connection with my back, so I can move weight with my back with a heavier weight. But what I'm really trying to squeeze and focus in detail on a row, on a dumbbell or a bent over row, I normally use a 10 kilo dumbbell or 10 kilo plates. So just to give you a context to what I use, you may need to go down from that, you may need to go up. And some of you have read my book, The Fitness Mindset, and in the training section where I speak about the mind-muscle connection, I'm talking about using the muscle and contracting the muscle that you're trying to work so that you're able to create extra resistance on that muscle and change the composition so that it looks better. Which basically means that when you're doing a row, you're working your back and you're not working your biceps, you're not working your forearms, and you're actually rowing with your back, which means that you're going to develop that muscle so that it looks better, it gets stronger, and it will actually pull everything back into alignment, so you actually may have even better posture as a result. Because what happens sometimes if you're rowing poorly, it can slouch you forward and put a lot of extra strain on your biceps as well, so there's all the risk of injury. So what I would advise anybody who can't feel their back on rows, it doesn't happen overnight. It's not as simple as other tips where I'll offer when girls can't squeeze their glutes, or guys that are someone coming through my GEA program, my athletes, where they're trying to feel their glutes. It's a lot easier because you can actually tap that muscle and feel it squeeze, but you can't do that with your back. But what I would advise is drop the weight back, tuck in your elbows, and then work for squeeze through your back. If you feel your biceps kicking in or your forearms kicking in, you've gone too heavy or else your form isn't right and you need to check back on it. So it might take a couple of weeks before you fully got it, where your back is doing all the pull and doing the complete fully contracted position at the top of the movement. So may worth even holding and squeezing the top part of a row so that your back is fully contracted and you're doing a little bit of an isometric squeeze at the top, which could further improve your mind-muscle connection potentially. And then when you are actually training, do that consistently on your row days until that mind-muscle connection gets better. And every time you row, then your back is taking it and it's not your biceps fatiguing, it's not your forearms fatiguing, and you're able to develop your back faster and you're able to change the body composition in a much better way. Okay, next question comes in from Aaron Flaherty 97 on Instagram. Am I better to only have carbohydrates at insulin-sensitive times or space them out through the day if fat loss is my goal, or does it even matter? So I spoke about this briefly in the nutrition section of my book, that I personally like having carbs at insulin-sensitive times. Which basically just means that insulin sensitivity means that your body is better at utilizing the carbohydrates you eat for energy. Insulin resistance is the opposite then. When you hear the term insulin resistance, it basically means that your body isn't very efficient at using carbohydrates as an energy source. And that's all carbohydrates really do, with the exception of some vitamins and minerals that are in carbohydrates. They give your body energy. There's no essential carbohydrate. There's essential fatty acids from fats. There's essential amino acids from protein. Essential meaning that your body can't make them. You need to get them from a food or a supplement, but there's no essential carbohydrate. So my personal preference is using them at insulin sensitive times, because you're definitely going to utilize them better for energy. And what can happen with some people, and the reason that there was this little bit of a carb phobia for a while, is excess carbs can definitely potentially increase your body fat. What happens is excess carbs go back to get stored as glycogen, and any excess glycogen that's stored goes back as body fat. So having too much carbohydrates and consistently consuming too many carbohydrates that you're not burning through can increase your body fat. It's not as simple as 1 + 1 = 2, cut the carbs and you'll lose body fat. But definitely overeating them for certain individuals who don't metabolize them that well can definitely increase their level of body fat. So in terms of eating them in insulin-sensitive times, which is normally after a fasted state, so normally first thing in the morning after you've slept, or after a workout when you've trained, you're going to be a lot more insulin sensitive. Now again, this is, I'm talking in the case of majority of people. There's people who will have their own genetic issues, or if you're obese or massively overweight and you're listening to this, you may have a level of insulin resistance that doesn't lend itself to insulin sensitive times. But for the majority of people listening, most people will be insulin sensitive after a fasted state. So first thing in the morning and post-workout. So having your carbohydrates at this time means that there's a very, very low risk that you're going to have any excess stored back as glycogen and any excess stored back as body fat. That's why I like having them at this time. There's other factors that come into play. If you're eating too many calories, you're going to potentially add body fat as well. If your training isn't right, if you're eating poor quality foods, lots of different factors that come into play here. So it's not as simple as eat your carbs at insulin-sensitive times and you won't put on body fat. Or you'll speed up your body's ability to use fat as a fuel source. But using carbohydrates at insulin-sensitive times, particularly complex carbohydrates, your oats, your sweet potato, your whole grain rice, your quinoa, using those carbohydrates can allow you to have the best of both worlds. Because what happens sometimes on a low carbohydrate diet is your energy levels can slump, particularly for those of you that don't fall into ketosis and don't drop your protein back. Some people will be following a ketogenic diet where it's predominantly fats, normally 80% or more, and you're falling into a ketogenic diet and your body's using ketosis as its main, or ketones as its main energy source. So those people don't tend to feel too poorly. But when you have low carbohydrate and you're just getting your energy from fat and proteins, sometimes you can feel that energy slump come as a result, because you're not getting those energy-giving foods which come from complex carbohydrates and carbohydrates in general. So I like it at insulin-sensitive times because it kind of gives you the best of both worlds. It keeps your energy levels up, which means your training intensity doesn't suffer, and it means you feel better throughout the day and you're less likely to store those carbohydrates as fat. However, spacing them out throughout the day depends on the training program you're following, depends on your body's ability to metabolize carbohydrates. and a couple of other genetic factors that may come into play. The truth is there is no one size fits all with carbohydrates. I've had people come through my online program that have had 0 to 50 grams of carbohydrates every day and they've worked amazingly well and lost body fat. I've had other people come through that have had 300 to 500 grams of carbohydrates every day because their body burns up carbohydrates so well. And depending on how carb or fat adapted you are, which basically just means that you tend to work better off one or the other. I'm, for example, very fat adapted. I can drop my carbs to 0 grams and I feel amazing. And my energy levels doesn't slump that much. My focus stays good. My training is pretty good. But if I drop my fats down and keep my carbs really high, I start to get sluggish and sleepy. And there was a great analogy or a great test that Ross Edley spoke about on the episode of the podcast, where if I offered you 2 breakfasts, if I said, right, you can have 200 grams of oats and honey and berries, or you can have a load of almond butter or natural peanut butter and eggs and avocado, which one would you prefer or gravitate towards? And generally, people that are fat adapted will way prefer to have a fat breakfast, and people that are carb adapted will way prefer to have a carbohydrate breakfast. Again, this is massively anecdotal, but it just kind of gives you an idea on whatever your brain goes to first. You're possibly going to be more fat adapted or carb adapted as a result of your answer. My test is generally drop your carbs back really low to 0 to 50 grams, increase your fats and see how you feel. If you feel really sluggish and you can't focus on anything, you're probably more carb adapted. If you feel incredible and your energy is really good and your focus is good and you feel super lean and your digestion is good, you're probably more fat adapted. So there's a couple of tests there, and then your nutritional plan will be based off the back of what you're more adapted to. So there are people that will lose body fat having super high carbohydrates, literally having carbohydrates in every single one of their meals. And there's other people that will have them in insulin-sensitive times and lose body fat. And there's other people who will have no carbohydrates at all during the day and they'll lose body fat. So it's not as straightforward as have them in insulin-sensitive times or space them throughout the day or don't have any at all. It's very much finding what works best for you. The reason I like insulin-sensitive times is it kind of gives you the best of both worlds. You don't have to cut them out completely and you're very unlikely to store them as body fat, provided you've got everything else in alignment with your overall nutrition, your overall calories and your training program. But in terms of finding what works best for you, by all means experiment with it, and as long as your body fat is reducing and you're changing and your composition is moving in the direction that you want, double down on the things that are working and then factor that into your nutritional strategy going forward. Okay, next question comes in from Weiss Adam on Snapchat. How do you know when supplements are working for you? So this is a great question because it's a little bit of a difficult one to answer, and I'm going to come at it from a different angle than I normally would, because depending on the supplement you're using is massively going to determine whether you feel it's working or not. So the best way to answer this, Adam, and anyone else that's wondering how you know if supplements work, is it depends on the category of supplements you're using. There's certain supplements you'll use and they'll give you nearly an instant effect. Things like caffeine, different stimulants, are all going to massively affect your sympathetic nervous system nearly instantly. Particularly if you've never had caffeine or that stimulant before. You'll take it and within 20 minutes, half an hour, you'll feel wired and you'll be really super focused and your energy will increase. Other supplements such as vitamin B12, which you're not going to know if you're deficient until a long period of time, and only when you start to get some neurodegenerative diseases or you start to have some issues with concentration will you feel that your body has been deficient in it. So they kind of fall on different ends of the spectrum. Caffeine and stimulants tend to be on one side that hits you nearly straight away, and vitamin B12 is a good example on another side because of the time it takes for your body to send signals that it's deficient in it. And then there's a lot that are in between. Things like your magnesium that will give you a little bit of an unwinding sensation if you take it and you're deficient, but nothing too crazy, and some people don't feel much of a relaxation with it, and then other people feel super relaxed. It also depends on how deficient you are in that mineral, for example. So it very much depends on the supplement. The ones that I'm a massive fan of tend to be the double placebo, double blind placebo tested supplements that have been scientifically proven over and over again to work. Things like creatine, that you're not necessarily going to feel hit you, but what will happen is when you saturate the cell with creatine, you start pulling more water underneath the muscle over a period of 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, depending on the form you're using, whether you have to load it or not, you may in the gym feel a little bit stronger. Because what happens with creatine, for an example, is it pulls water underneath your cell. So if you picture a 2 liter water bottle and it's an empty water bottle, you can bend and crack a 2 liter water bottle and move it in any direction you want. If you fill it up with 2 liters of water, it's very, very hard to move it, and you can increase the resistance and pressure you can put on it. That's what creatine does for your muscle. It pulls water underneath the muscle, so when you're lifting weights or adding any resistance to your body, you're able to potentially move more weight than you normally would for the same reps, or you're able to do more reps with the weight that you normally lift for, you know, 8 to 10 reps. You're now able to do 12 to 15 because there's water pulled underneath the muscle and you're able to increase the resistance on it. So that's one that you wouldn't necessarily notice until you actually just feel that little bit stronger in the gym. So they fall on different categories in terms of their effect on the body and how fast you'll notice them and if you'll notice them at all. So it's not as simple as saying, well, this supplement will work and you'll notice it straight away, and this one won't work and you won't know until 10 years down the line if you're deficient and you have some form of disease or issue that comes up as a result of a mineral deficiency or a vitamin deficiency. So I tend to kind of go off the back of the ones that are the most scientifically researched, that have been shown time and time again to work, and then factoring those in based off the goals. The truth is, there are certain supplements that most people will lean towards, like high quality whey protein, creatine for building muscle, caffeine for losing body fat, green tea extract in my case is my personal favorite, and then other supplements that kind of fall in between, depending on where and the population that may be deficient. So I would generally say, when you understand your nutritional strategy that you're applying to your own life, or you're working with a coach, or you're working with somebody who's designing your nutritional strategy, you will see where you're potentially going to be deficient. So for example, if you're a vegan, it's probably very important that you get vitamin B12 into your nutrition, because you're not going to get it from red meat. You may also struggle to get zinc in unless you're eating a lot of pumpkin seeds. You may struggle to get those vitamins and minerals into your body that you would get from, say, red meat, for example. Whereas somebody that eats a lot of red meat probably doesn't need to supplement with zinc. You probably don't need to supplement with creatine. You're going to get it from the red meat. Same as oily fish. If you don't eat any oily fish, there's a good chance you're not getting your omega-3s or a high-quality omega-3 into your diet unless you're eating loads of flax seeds or linseeds and you're hedging your bets with those other foods. So depending on the nutritional strategy you're following, that's where your supplements will come in, because they will supplement back in what you're missing. And this is why they're only the last 5% or 10%. And I've spoken in the past on other podcast episodes about how I was super reliant on supplements, not realizing that in the name, supplements literally mean they'll supplement what you're missing. And that's the best way to choose them. Some people are going to work really well off creatine. If you don't eat any red meat and you haven't in 5 years, you're probably going to respond pretty quickly to creatine because your body's not used to it and you're not getting it elsewhere. Whereas if you eat red meat 5 times a week, you may take creatine and you're just, you know, urinating the excess because your body's not using it. Same way as if you're not eating oily fish and you're not eating a lot of linseeds or flaxseeds or different food groups that have high omega-3, you may find that you're supplementing back in your omega-3 and your concentration improves. So again, it's not a one size fits all in terms of knowing if it's working for you. There's a little bit of making sure that you're using ones that are based around your specific goals that have been scientifically proven to work, whatever it is that you're trying to achieve, and then factoring in the ones that you may be deficient in because you're lacking them from the nutrition and the food that you're eating. So hopefully that makes sense, Adam, and anybody else that's wondering about how to find out if supplements are working for them. Certain ones you'll feel straight away. Some you won't literally know until another 10 or 12 years unless you have a problem, and then a lot fall somewhere in between where you're deficient in zinc or magnesium or whatever in vitamin or mineral it is, and you supplement it back in and you just feel better. That is generally the way you'll tell if they're working, and that can largely be determined and seen when you look at someone's nutritional plan. I can look at a nutritional plan and realize that, right, that person's probably going to be deficient in omega-3, let's add that supplement in there. That person's probably going to be deficient in zinc, let's add zinc back in there. You can also tell from your training program, things like zinc, glutamine is an amino acid, in high-end trainers normally get deficient. So vitamin D in people that are in hot, in cold countries, Ireland, the UK, probably going to be deficient in vitamin D. You can kind of tell from different lifestyles, the population, the, where people are living, and the nutritional strategies they're following in the training program they're on, where they're possibly going to be deficient and what supplements would work best. So sometimes it's worth working with the coach or working with a nutritionist or working with somebody who knows that and can design it for you. And then other times it's just upskilling your own knowledge on it and then figuring out where you may be deficient and then building your supplements based around that. Okay, next question comes in from Anonymous on Snapchat. Any tips for giving up weed? It's starting to have a really negative effect on my life, but I'm really struggling to give it up. So I had some really good feedback. I answered this question on a Snapchat Q&A, and I'm going to flesh it out here because of the amount of feedback I got back. Also because it applies to the majority of non-physiologically addictive things that we may be consuming in our lives. So hopefully anybody that has an issue with food or cigarettes or alcohol or weed will hopefully get some benefit from this answer, and I'll try and provide as much value on that as I can. So the good news and the bad news with giving up weed is, the good news is it's not physiologically addictive. It's not like heroin or cocaine or crystal meth that will literally trigger dopamine in your brain and it's physiologically addictive. When you take heroin or you take cocaine away from somebody, they're going to actually have a physical craving for it because of the ability of that drug to have an effect on dopamine receptors in the brain. Weed doesn't do that, so it's not physiologically addictive. So the good news is it's actually easier to give up from a physiological and a physical standpoint compared to other drugs. But on the negative side of that, the things that tend to trigger cravings for weed tend to be a lot more environmental or social, which are a little bit harder to cut. So I'm going to expand on how changing up your environment or changing up your pattern or changing up the habit or even the social cues that you're in where the craving is triggering can potentially help you give it up the long term and then get your life back on track as a result. So before I get into how incredibly important it is to understand the effect of habits and your environment, there was a study done on soldiers from the Vietnam War who were addicted to heroin when they were living in Vietnam, and how when they came back to the US, their cravings completely disappeared and they stopped using heroin. But when they went back to Vietnam, you know, 15, 20 years later, they got those cravings back. And it's one of really groundbreaking research, and it is worth looking up on the effect of environment on cravings, because things like heroin, which are physically craving for the body, opiate drugs are probably the most physically addictive things you can put into your body. And the fact that people were able to go to another country and then when they changed up their environment, their cravings disappeared and they were no longer addicted to heroin is incredible to think of, because when you're physically addicted to something, it shouldn't matter where you are in the world or where your environment is. An addict, particularly something like heroin or any opioid, you should be physically addicted regardless of where you are. But what happened with these soldiers was when they came back to the US, and also it wasn't as readily available as it was in Vietnam, they found that they just didn't crave it anymore. And after a certain period of time, they weren't in the environment, they weren't with the same people who they used to shoot up with, and they weren't in the actual Vietnamese area, and they just went back to living their normal lives. That can give you an indicator of how important an actual stimulus of in being in certain environments can be in terms of giving up an addiction or giving up any sort of thing that you're craving. Smokers are a great example of this, and anyone that's a smoker, particularly a social smoker who smokes on nights out, at weekends, or when they're out, and when you go into a smoking area, you feel this automatic craving for a cigarette, particularly if it's your local your local bar, your local club, or the place you go regularly, you get this craving as soon as you step into the environment because your body sends a stimulus, sends a trigger. It's a cue, trigger, reward. There's a great book by Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit, and I referenced it in my book in the habit section on how we have cue, trigger, rewards for habits. And a cue for a smoker going into a smoking area on a night out is the cue is walking into the smoking area, the trigger is being in that environment, and then the reward is the dopamine hit or the stimulant hit you're getting from having a cigarette. And it's incredible what can happen with even smokers when you remove the club or the environment from that routine that they normally have on a night out. I've had a couple of people come through my program who were smokers and needed help giving them up. And when we break it down, some of them would go out at their local, and they're only social smokers, some of these people. I had one girl in particular who every college night out on a Wednesday and a Thursday, she would go to the smoking area in her local nightclub, and she would literally have a cigarette every time she was out. And I told her for the duration of the program, which was 6 weeks at the time, I said, don't go to that club. I was like, just all I want you to do, you can go out and have your drinks, but for giving up your cigarettes, just don't go to that club. And as a result, she didn't get that environmental trigger every time she went into the smoking area because it had changed up the actual routine. And as a result, it was a lot easier to not feel that physical craving when she went into that smoking area that she was so used to being in. And sometimes, again, of course, it's going to be a physiological craving. You're going to physically want it. But when you give yourself all the potential ammunition to help yourself and all the information on what can help support you, it gives you a chance to win an otherwise potential losing battle. If you're doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result, that's the literal definition of insanity. If you go into the dictionary and read the definition of insanity, it's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. If you go to the same club continuously over and over again, and you're going to the smoking area over and over again, and you're expecting a different result, that's the literal definition of insanity. And when it comes to giving up weed, I would nearly guarantee that there's some form of cue that you have created or a habit that you've created in your life that is lending itself to triggering off that craving in your body. So maybe that you're working all day and you're coming home and you're sitting down and watching your favorite shows and then you're lighting up and you're smoking a joint or you're doing whatever it is, a bong or whatever way you're smoking it, or you're going to your group of friends and that group of friends are all smokers and it triggers it off you. And again, if you don't want to slip, don't go to slippery places. If you're hanging out with people who are all smoking and you're trying to give it up, willpower has been shown time and time again to run out, and it's not unlimited. So if you are in an environment with social friends and they're all smoking weed or they're all doing something that you don't want to do, willpower is eventually going to give out. So you're better off sometimes you just remove yourself from that situation. There's a great book by Kelly McGonigal called The Willpower Instinct, where she talks about that when we go out throughout the day and we're consistently saying no to people, and in that case, for some people, it could be just not telling your boss to fuck off because they were giving out to you. It could be, you know, not saying no to the donuts or the chocolates that are the biscuits at work. That willpower can run out, and then later on in the day, it's so much easier to give into it. And that can happen when you're in an environment with people that are doing the thing that you don't want to do. So sometimes you're better to remove yourself from that. What I would advise anybody that's in a situation, and in the context of this answer for someone trying to give up weed, I would make a mental accounting list of all the situations where you normally and regularly smoke weed. And I guarantee you, if you make a list over the last month or the last 2 months or the last 3 months, it's going to be the same situations coming up over and over and over again. You're coming home from work and you're smoking and lighting up, or you're going over to your friend's house, or you're doing something that is habitual and you've created a bad habit. The University of London says it takes 66 days to form a new habit, and you've created a habit around a certain environment that is automatically triggering that craving. That's why you're not able to give it up. And by all means, there's going to be a certain amount of control and willpower that you need to do with it, but give yourself a fighting chance by making a mental account of all those environments that you go in and the routines that you've created and the habits that you've created, and then hijack those, you know, over the space of, it may take you 66 days, it may take you shorter, it may take you longer, but make a list of all the times that you smoke weed and then do something else. If you're coming home after work and you're normally sitting down to smoke a joint or whatever it is that you do at that time, create a new habit. Go somewhere else on your way home. I spoke in my book in the habit section how I created a bad habit when I used to work as a primary school teacher. I would come in, I would get my bar 100 gram of dark chocolate, my 100 gram of chocolate from the press or from the cupboard, and then I would sit in front of the game shows. And then after doing this for a couple of months, I started to add body fat, and it was just a bad habit that I created. And what I did was, instead of coming into the house, what was happening for me was I was literally coming in the front door, I was putting down my school bag, I was going into the kitchen, going into the cupboard, taking out the chocolates, going into the sitting room, sitting down, watching the game shows and eating the chocolates. What I had to do was, I couldn't change my cue of coming home every day, because I come home from work, that was set Monday to Friday. But what I could do was, I would pre-pack a gym bag, I would leave it at the front door, and then I would trade bags as soon as I came home, and then I started going to the gym. And as a result, my cue was, instead of going to the cupboard for chocolate, I was taking my gym bag and I was going to the gym. My routine now was moving towards the gym and going towards the gym after work, and my reward was the serotonin hit I was getting from working out, as opposed to eating chocolate. So sometimes you just have to hack the cue, routine, reward, and that can support you when you change up the environment and you make a list of all the triggers, either socially or environmentally, that you regularly put yourself in that position. Same thing goes for smokers, same thing goes for drinkers to a degree. It's a little bit physiologically easier with weed, because it's not as addictive as, say, cigarettes, which are actually physically addictive with nicotine. But the same advice can apply, and I've had people very, very successfully give up cigarettes and give up different things that weren't supporting them in their life by literally having a little bit of self-control on top of setting yourself up with the right mental framework or the right toolkit on what you need to do in order to succeed and set yourself up for success in whatever area of your life that is. And in this context, it's giving up weed so you can take control of your life again, even though you're struggling to give it up. So hopefully anybody listening here that is in the same boat with either weed or something else that's not supporting you, maybe chocolate, maybe food, and in a lot of cases, I know people that are listening will resonate in some way with, you know, food or fizzy drinks or whatever it is we're addicted to. It was my own personal issue with those. It wasn't weed for me. It was chocolate and sugar for me. But the same thing applies. Cue, routine, reward. Make a mental list of the environments and the social triggers of where it is that you normally consume that vice, and then make sure that if you don't want to slip, you don't go to slippery places. Don't put yourself in the environment, and then just hack that cue, routine, reward. Set up a new habit. Realize it may take 66 days or more to form a new habit. And then again, the compound effect kicks in. The snowball effect kicks in. Tell me what you do every day and I'll tell you where you'll be in 10 years. So when you set yourself up and you fix that vice now and that problem now, it's going to play out for you in a positive sense over the next year, next 2 years, next 5 years, next 10 years, and you'll look back and it was just something that you worked through in your life. Whereas if you keep doing it now, you're going to keep coming back and go, well, I need to fix this, I need to fix this, I need to fix this. And you're going to have that negative self-talk that comes along with it. And it's the old adage that when you're trying to change a habit, and this is one of the references I put in the book, it's easier to change a habit when it's a little bit fresh or hasn't been ingrained in your central nervous system for the last 20 years. It's like digging up a seed from the ground. It's easier to dig up a seed when it's been planted in the last month, the last year even. But if you let it grow for 20 years and it becomes an oak tree, it's significantly harder to pull up, and habits are the exact same. I love the Charlie Munger quote that the chains of habits are too light to be felt until they're too strong to be broken. So I would advise nipping that now, because otherwise that chains of habit are going to get stronger and stronger, and they're going to be more difficult to break every month, every year, every decade that you leave it. So that's everything from today's episode. For more information on me or my programs, head over to briankeenfitness.com. My Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube's all Brian Keen Fitness. My Snapchat, BrianK019. And my other podcast for GA players, my GA Lean Body Podcast, is on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you so much for listening. Catch you all real soon.